coalition because the country is changing so much. Does it appear that Donald Trump has actually 4 years later done that?
You know, I would say that actually Trump did better amongst Hispanics than Romney did, and did better amongst African Americans than Romney did. It wasn't really just an all-white electorate. Now, that being said, he did go for that white middle class or white working class in a way that Romney never could, and he excited voters that never voted before in ways that, by taking really and taking the Democratic position on a lot of issues like trade and other economic.
And we should be clear, according to exit polls, he did very badly among Latinos and African Americans. But you're right, there have been some exit polls saying he did a tick or so better than President
Obama. I agree with that entirely. The only thing is that, you know, the one factor I have to leave out is that that Barack Obama was on the ticket the last two races, and he's a much more compelling person to minority voters than Hillary Clinton is.
So is there a civil war in the Republican Party right now?
I think the civil war, I'm open to correction on this, but I planned on talking all about the Republican Civil War, the conservative Civil War. I was going to write about it today. I was going to talk about it today. I think it is on hold.
On hold.
It is on hold because we're waiting to see how Donald Trump is actually going to behave as the next president of the United States. If he goes one way and fulfills the promises of his conservative supporters, then maybe there isn't. I think, on the other hand, I think the new hot take is that the Democratic Party may be heading into a civil war.
John Ferry, let's look at this moment and what Donald Trump is going to do or has to do. Is there a way for him to appeal to the voters who brought him into office last night, but also try and mend fences with people like House Speaker Paul Ryan?
I think there is a way, and it's through effective action. I think it's also through hiring good people. I mean, I think the biggest concern a lot of people had in this election about Donald Trump was the fact that he has no idea what he's doing. And so if he can hire some good people, start listening to people in ways that, you know, are compelling, and actually start governing in a way that actually can show that he knows how to govern, which we don't know yet. I think that's the way he can
although
get things together.
We had our congressional correspondent Elsa Chang on earlier this morning, and she began ticking off policy differences between Paul Ryan, Speaker of the House, and Donald Trump. You could start with trade. You could go on to immigration. You could go on to his Muslim ban or whatever it's become. And she went on for quite some time. Are they at all on the same page?
Yeah, look, let me put my conservative media critic hat on. The Republicans just won this historic election.
Right.
They now basically run the whole country, state, local races, all over the country. The coverage is going to be, as it always is with these things, how this is a problem for Republicans. Right. Meanwhile, the Democrats, the Democratic establishment,
total disaster,
has been decimated. I said the Republican Civil War is on hold. I didn't say it's not coming. Right.
You're being very careful there.
Yeah. I think it all depends on how Donald Trump behaves and whether or not he picks fights with his own side, as we know he has the capacity to do, or whether or not he actually tries to galvanize the GOP now that he actually won.
Scott Detrow, let me bring you into this conversation. You've spent a lot of time talking to voters. I mean, last night, Donald Trump, before his supporters in that hotel, saying he wants to be a president for all Americans. Do his supporters, do the people who supported him so fervently, want him to reach out and unify? That didn't seem to be the message that really resonated with them.
No, I think that's a great question, and I think that there was a lot of grievance in the coalition that Donald Trump put together, and I think that's something he talked about day in, day out. He painted a very dark picture of the country. He said some parts may be doing great, but the part where my supporters are isn't. It's been left behind, and I want to fix that. That's the message that resonated, and it clearly worked in places like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, and he's ahead in Michigan, though we haven't called it yet. Those are places where typically Democrats run up big, big margins in the cities and suburbs, and that is more the rural vote. But the rural vote was energized in these states and carried him to victory in a way that Democrats haven't done in decades in those states.
Very briefly, John Feary, do you see a way that the Republicans, having won everything, as we said, can work with Democrats who still have the power in the Senate, especially, to stop things?
Well, they have to, and good news for Republicans is Harry Reid left and Chuck Schumer is in as leader, as minority leader. I think Schumer and McConnell are going to be able to get stuff done on immigration and the economy.
He's a hardcore partisan, but you're saying he's also a practical guy.
He's practical, and he can cut deals, and we need to cut deals to move the country forward.
John Feary and Jonah Goldberg, thanks to both of you. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Stock market futures dove as the election results became apparent last night. NPR's John Itzy is here to tell us what's happening now. John, what do you got?
Well, investors were surprised and unnerved last night, and stocks dropped dramatically in Japan. The Nikkei closed down 5.5%. But since then, markets have moderated. Major European indexes are down less than 1% right now, and U.S. futures predict U.S. markets will open down about 1.5% when they open in about 15 minutes. And the reason for the turbulence, markets don't like surprises. And they got a big one last night. The other reason, uncertainty about Donald Trump's economic policies. For instance, will he tear up trade deals or try to improve them? In other words, is he going to be a populist or a pragmatist?
Okay, so many questions unanswered. And for the moment, the market's maybe not panicking as much as people fear. John, thanks very much.
You bet.
That's NPR's John Hinsky.
And joining us now to discuss how those results will affect the Supreme Court is NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's start, Nina, with the immediate effect of Donald Trump being the next president of the United States.
Well, the vacancy created by the death of Justice Antonin Scalia almost a year ago will now be filled not by Obama nominee Merrick Garland, but by a Trump nominee. And with Republicans continuing to control the U.S. Senate, that nominee will almost certainly be easily confirmed, and the court will then revert to the conservative 5-4 majority that's prevailed for decades.
What do we know now, though, about how Donald Trump would choose his nominee?
We don't actually know a lot. He's issued two long lists of potential nominees. Significant is who's not on that list. Some of the most distinguished conservative judges and lawyers in the country are not on that list. We don't know who the most influential people will be. We don't know any of that. We just sort of have to take it on faith that this is going to be a very conservative nominee because all of the people on the list are very conservative potential nominees.
And there is one vacancy on the court now, as we've just said. What to expect in the next 4 years?
Well, it's entirely possible that we'll have more vacancies. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg is 83. Justice Stephen Breyer, also a Democratic appointee, is 78. Justice Anthony Kennedy, a sort of center-right justice appointed by President Reagan, he's 80. Any or all of those people could retire or be hit with health problems, etc. And it's entirely conceivable that in the next 4 years we'll have three more vacancies and that we would have the Trump effect on the court for generations to come. So you could imagine the court's abortion decision, for example, Roe versus Wade reversed. You could imagine a court that's already quite sympathetic to the business community becoming much more so, a court more hostile to regulations overall, a court far more deferential to religious objections to anti-discrimination laws. And these are just the ones I can think of off the top of my head. For the last half century, Renee, until Justice Scalia's death, the Supreme Court has had a majority of Republican-nominated justices. But what's been really unusual about the last 8 years is the deep suspicion evidenced by the court conservatives about executive power, presidential power, and the relative deference of the court's liberals. So it's going to be particularly interesting to see if that changes when the president is a Republican with an agenda instead of a Democrat with an agenda.
NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg, thanks very much.
Thank you, Renee.
18 minutes after 8 as Morning Edition continues here on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. No morning show with Greg Berg today because we're offering up the expanded post-election coverage from National Public Radio. Greg will be back tomorrow. And we will take a quick check. Well, let's let you know up next on the program, voters across the country also cast ballots in congressional races. Unofficial results indicate Republicans will keep control of the House and Senate. So that story is up shortly. Next up, the forecast details from the National Weather Service.
Support comes from Gateway. Lock in a job, learn a trade on site and in class, and get paid as you go. Apprenticeships are available in a growing variety of areas, including industrial manufacturing tech, machine repair, plumbing, and mechatronics. Call Nikki at 262-564-2952.
Looks like a fine fall day coming our way today. Sunny and seasonal, with a high heading 457. We've got some cloud cover out there right now, but the sun will be back. We're in the 40s now, just about everywhere, 42 degrees in Racine, 40 right now in Kenosha, 37 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and in Lake Geneva.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Later this morning, Hillary Clinton will be commenting on her loss to Donald Trump in Tuesday's presidential election. Despite leading in the popular vote, the Democratic nominee got beat in the electoral count as Trump won key states, including Florida, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Wisconsin. NPR's Sarah McCammon says Clinton phoned Trump early this morning after it became clear she'd lost.
During his victory speech to a crowd of supporters at a hotel in Manhattan, President-elect Trump sounded very different from the presidential candidate. He congratulated his Democratic rival, Hillary Clinton, and told supporters they owe her a debt of gratitude for her service to our country. After a contentious and divisive campaign, Trump also promised to be president for all Americans.
Trump's been invited to the White House tomorrow for talks with President Obama. Republicans will keep control of Congress in January, having maintained majorities in the House and Senate, NPR's Elsa Chang reports.
Even in this outsider year, the year of Trump, Republicans were able to hang on to control of the Senate because their Republican incumbents were able to survive. We saw this in Missouri and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and North Carolina. One bright spot for Democrats was they were able to fend off a challenge to the seat of outgoing Minority Leader Harry Reid.
Democrats picked up one Senate seat when Illinois Congresswoman Tammy Duckworth defeated Senator Mark Kirk. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
And good morning for WGTD News. I'm Dave McGrath. Despite pre-election polls that suggested a different outcome, Wisconsin went for Donald Trump last night by 3 percentage points, 49-46. Here are the results from the other races on the ballot. Congressman Paul Ryan easily retained his first congressional district seat, beating Ryan Solon. Incumbent GOP Senator Ron Johnson also defied the polls and beat Russ Feingold by about 7 points. There were no surprises in local legislative races. GOP Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, Democrat Corey Mason, and Republicans Tyler August and Samantha Kirkman all won their races. All other local legislative races were uncontested. Statewide at this point, the Democrats are still in danger of losing maybe up to 3 state Senate seats. Final counts are still being tabulated. In a hard-fought and sometimes bitter race in Racine, Republican Assistant DA Patricia Hansen defeated Democrat Thomas Binger, a Kenosha County Assistant DA. She won by a 53-38 margin. The current DA, Rich Schipetti, decided not to run for re-election. And on a 3-1 margin, voters in the city of Burlington approved an advisory referendum to build a new $5.4 million community swimming pool. The final vote on the pool project rests with the Burlington City Council at its December 6th meeting. Coming up now on 22 Minutes Past the Hour.
NPR comes from NPR member stations and from American Express, offering charging credit cards to help business owners cover the big purchases they need to make when they need to make them. More about American Express business cards and services can be found at open.com. From Zillow, recognizing home means something different to everyone. Users can discover millions of homes for sale and rent, from a modern apartment in the city to a historic home in the suburbs. Zillow, find your way home. From Lumber Liquidators, a proud sponsor of NPR, offering more than 400 styles, including hardwood, bamboo, laminate, and vinyl, with flooring specialists in hundreds of stores nationwide. More at lumberliquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News with Renee Montaigne and David Green. I'm Stephen. Good morning. We are waiting this morning to hear from former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who did not deliver a concession speech overnight, but is expected to talk in the next little while. Donald Trump has won the Electoral College and the presidency, as he was able to proclaim in a victory speech early this morning. Clinton does lead in the popular vote, which has no legal effect, but would have a political one if that is the final result. Let's talk now with Leslie Wims of the Democratic African American Women Caucus in Florida. Welcome back to the program.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Some weeks ago, we had you on the program, and you said very forcefully you didn't think that Hillary Clinton was doing enough to reach out to African American voters in Florida. Did anything change after we talked?
Nothing changed after we talked. She and her campaign did not do as I suggested and get into the African-American community and engage. What they did is they continued with the surrogates. President Obama made several more trips to Florida, to Orlando, to South Florida. Other surrogates came, and as you can see, Hillary Clinton did not win Florida.
Well, tell me then, are you saying that this was all along a winnable election, that the campaign just didn't get the technical aspects of it right?
No question about it. She could have blown Donald Trump away if she had engaged her most faithful demographic voting bloc, the African Americans. And it actually extends beyond Florida, as you can see, Pennsylvania, Michigan. You know, all she needed to do was engage the community. And she did not do that. And as you can see, we have a President Donald Trump.
Although, what do you make of people who've said all morning long that, that the public seemed to want change, or a large part of the country seemed to want change, and Trump was able to sell himself as the change that was available, and even people who didn't necessarily think he was qualified seemed to have voted for him?
Well, I agree with that. When you look, when you go back to the primary and you look at Bernie Sanders, he was definitely for change, and you see all of the people that, that really resonated with his, or his message resonated with. With Donald Trump, it was a similar thing, and Hillary Clinton represented the establishment in a climate where people really wanted change, and we see now that President Trump, President-elect Trump, is what we have. So I agree with that. I agree that people want to change. But for Hillary Clinton, if she wanted to overcome that, she needed to do a lot more. And she didn't do that. So,
how big a defeat is this for Democrats and for you, for people that you care about?
It is a huge defeat. But I think that it's an opportunity to go back to the drawing board. I think that there's a lot of house cleaning that needs to be done. For me, as a Florida resident, particularly with the Florida Democratic Party, I think we have a chair, we have an executive director. We need to clean house totally. I mean, I'm not going to put the complete blame on the Hillary campaign because, you know, our chair and our director, they knew the climate and they could have directed her, and they did not do that. So I think that in addition to her defeat, we need to clean house here.
Let me just add, we just got a few seconds here, but I'd like to know, there were about 8% of African Americans who voted for Donald Trump, not a large number, but number. And he says he wants to be a president for everyone. In a few seconds, do you think there's something good that, that you could get out of this presidency?
I think that's the African Americans telling the Democratic Party to stop taking our vote for granted. I think that's the African Americans telling the Democratic Party that you have to court our vote and that we're tired of you just assuming that because you're Democrats and we're Democrats that you can count on us and you don't have to address our issues.
Leslie Wims of the Democratic African American Women Caucus in Florida. Thank you very much again.
Thank you for having me.
All morning, we'll be checking in with our correspondents around the globe to see how the world is reacting to the election of Donald Trump.
And let's turn now to Seoul, South Korea, where we find our colleague Elise Hugh. Elise, good morning.
Good morning.
So what is the view from Asia of this big news?
A lot of stunned disbelief, David. Regionally, and as has been the case with global markets, there's a lot of real uncertainty right now. As you know, this campaign season has really been driven by personality, not policy. And that means there's a lot of open questions. Now, Donald Trump has made a lot of statements on the topic of Asia, full of bluster, things like slapping giant tariffs on Chinese imports and pulling troops out of U.S. alliance partners, Korea and Japan. But there's no clear sense right now of what he's actually going to do once he's in power, but wide expectation that something will change.
And Elise, you are a 90-minute drive from the border with North Korea, which has steadily increased its nuclear capacity over the last 8 years. What do we know about how President Trump will take American policy, where it will take it with regard to North Korea?
Well, the president-elect has said very little with regard to this flashpoint, which is an extremely complex one because it involves China, it involves the entire Northeast Asian region really working together. I spoke with John Delury about this. He's a China historian and North Korea expert who teaches at Yonsei University here in Seoul.
Does Donald Trump have a North Korea policy? I think that's one of the first questions we need to ask. What has he said? He said he would sit down with Kim Jong-un, which, okay, that actually might be an all right starting point. But what's the conversation? What's the strategy? What's the policy?
Okay, Lisa, briefly put this all together. What do you do if you're South Korean leaders? You don't know what the U.S. president is going to exactly do when you're dealing with something sensitive like North Korea.
Well, they are a partner, of course, to the U.S. in formulating policy on North Korea. A lot of emergency meetings are actually happening here tonight to talk out not only national security concerns, but also trade and economic concerns. We are in uncharted waters here in Northeast Asia.
Okay, that is NPR's Elise Hugh, one of the foreign correspondents in NPR who will be checking in with about reaction this morning. Thanks, Elise.
You bet.
All right, overnight, we called back some of the voters we met this fall while traveling the divided states of this country, and one was farmer John Jackson from outside Milledgeville, Georgia.
I'm extremely excited, exhausted. I probably should have talked to my a doctor first before I watch this.
Mr. Jackson is a veteran, and Trump's regular promises to take care of veterans won his support.
You know, so many people are quick to you know, to strike the hammer and say, hey, let's go and fight. But when we come back home, they're not so quick to take care of us.
That's John Jackson from just outside of Milledgeville, Georgia. He's one of the voters we met in our Divided States project throughout this fall. We're hearing from them throughout this morning. This is NPR News.
And we bid you a brisk good morning. This is WGTD-HD, 91.1 FM in Kenosha and Racine, 101.7 in Elkhorn, and 103.3 in Lake Geneva. You're listening to Morning Edition for this Wednesday, November 9th. I'm Dave McGrath. Coming up in the next half hour, what is the real future of Obamacare under President Donald Trump? Analysis on the way. Now, the local headlines. Congressman Paul Ryan and Senator Ron Johnson both easily retained their seats in yesterday's election. We'll also look at local results. Also, it was 55 years ago tonight in 1961, a very young record store owner named Brian Epstein saw an unknown group named the Beatles perform at the Cavern Club in Liverpool for the very first time. He soon became their manager, and as we are wont to say, the rest is history. WGTD's Sports and Weather up next.
Support comes from Kenosha Winter Harbor Market, indoors for the season at the Rodie. This week featuring a new vendor, La Tarte Bakery. Sweetbreads, novelty cookies, miniature pies, croissants, and more. The market's new indoor hours are 10 to 2 on Saturdays.
Well, this week on WGTD's Noon Tunes, we're featuring the music of Kenosha singer-songwriter Haley Klinkhammer. At the end of every WGTD midday newscast, we feature a song by a local artist. So please join us for Noon Tunes, Monday through Friday, 12:20 p.m., here on WGTD HD.
Support comes from Gateway Technical College. Are you creative? Got a flair for home decorating? Channel your skills into an exciting and diverse career with an associate's degree in interior design. Turn concepts into reality through hands-on learning, seminars, and internships. Information at gtc.edu/programs.
Coming up on 8:33 as we take another check on WGTD Sports and Weather. NBA, Bucks and Bulls both off last night. Bucks get another night off tonight. The Bulls will play in Atlanta. NHL, the Blackhawks skate in St. Louis. The WGTD Wednesday forecast from the National Weather Service. Great day today, sunny and seasonal, a high of 57. Normal high this time of year would be 50, so hooray for us. 42 now Racine, 40 in Kenosha. It is 37 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and in Lake Geneva.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Battelle, supplying U.S. troops with technology for operating in dangerous environments. More at battelle.org/NPR. Battelle, it can be done. From Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, working to unleash the immune system power to fight cancer and develop promising new therapies. Videos, white papers, and patient stories are available at discovercarebelieve.org. And from the National Endowment for the Arts, Art Works.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News with Steve Inskeep and Renee Montaigne. I'm David Green. And it is hard to remember a relationship with the media as strained as the one Donald Trump had during the course of this campaign and how Donald Trump will be president of the United States. Let's talk about the relationship we expect him to have with the media going forward. NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik is on the line. David, good morning.
Good morning, David.
Tell me how strained that relationship was. I mean, at Donald Trump rallies, he would often begin by just making nasty comments about the reporters who were following him around, right?
you know, it's been a thread in particularly Republican politics to take pot shots at the press for about a half a century.
Flickers on the line. David, good morning.
Good morning, David.
Just tell me how strained that relationship was. I mean, this was, at Donald Trump rallies, he would often begin by just making nasty comments about the reporters who were following him around, right?
You know, it's been a thread in particularly Republican politics to take pot shots at the press for about a half century. But let me just say, this is a really unprecedented moment for the press. It's going to have to figure out how to negotiate a relationship with a guy who, as you say, has attacked news organizations, but also individual reporters by name. Who has threatened to sue the New York Times for libel, who said that he would go after Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, but also individually the owner of the Washington Post, because he was upset with the reporting of that newspaper, and has argued for a loosening of the libel laws to make it easier to win verdicts against news organizations. This is somebody who, you know, stands in some ways, at least rhetorically, against the values of what news organizations, what journalism stands for. This is just going to be a new figure and a new way of looking at things, at least if the campaign is a guide.
And we should say much of what you're talking about, the very strained relationship with the press, the attacking them at times, are things that Donald Trump supporters seem to really like. I mean, they drew them to the candidate.
Yeah, you know, look, it's hard to look at any one individual supporter and say that represents the campaign. But Trump has time and time again, essentially encouraged at rallies a hostility toward the press, pointing at them, saying, you know, basically trying to shame them to the degree that in some instances individual reporters were hustled out of sites from security agents or from by the Secret Service itself. You know, that's a degree of antagonism that we simply haven't seen. If you think about in the past, certainly Joe McCarthy, you know, somebody who used to inveigh against the press as a regular element of his campaign against communists and the Red Scare mm-hmm. in the 1950s, he also used to go for drinks with journalists, basically indicating it's all a show. And there's a way in which that may be the case with Donald Trump. After all, he wouldn't have the 100% name recognition he had during this race if not for his role as a fixture, as a media star in reality shows, and that bled over into news programming, during the 2000s in particular. But I've got to say that, you know, it's not clear how this antagonism will manifest itself, and that's something that the press is going to have to think hard about.
And I guess it's worth saying that the news media believes that they play this enormously important role when it comes to covering, I mean, any government, but covering an institution like the White House, to hold a president accountable, to ask tough questions, to hold a president's feet to the fire. Do you really believe those important roles in a democracy are at risk here, or is it possible that once Donald Trump settles in as president, this might kind of go back to the way we have seen in the past?
Well, so there are two ways of thinking about this, one of which is the press. You know, this is not only an unprecedented moment in terms of the president-elect, but an utterly unexpected one, especially by the press. Both the punditry and the pollsters just simply got this wrong, right? And so they're going to have to figure out, is he somebody that they're going to provide skeptical but not cynical coverage, which is kind of the model they publicly espouse? Are they going to be adversarial but not hostile? Or are they going to, in a moment of great tectonic shifts, both financially and in terms of the model of the press, become more oppositional? It's worth noting that even if you put the questions of partisanship against the press aside, some of the values that the press has that transcends party, you know, in terms of civil liberties, in terms of transparency, but that they tend to embrace, are at odds with at least the rhetoric of Donald Trump. So what do they do to hold him accountable? Or are they relying on the fact that it has certainly been shown over the years that Trump doesn't always believe everything he says or doesn't intend to do everything that comes out of his mouth? Are they relying on, to a degree, an element of insincerity in what he's put forth to the American people? And the answer is we don't know, and the press doesn't know, and I think the press has to be very humble going forward about what it does know and what it doesn't.
Okay, talking to NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik about Donald Trump's relationship with the media. David, thanks as always.
You bet.
We're going next to London in the United Kingdom, which had a dramatic vote of its own over the summer, a vote to leave the European Union. Many people compared that vote in Britain with the election in the United States, and today that comparison is ever more explicit. In London is NPR's Frank Langfitt. Frank, how are you?
Hey, good morning, Steve.
So how did people respond where you are?
Well, I actually went to the U.S. Embassy last night. There were a lot of British people there as well as U.S. expats, and people were shocked. It was a very pro-Clinton crowd, and there were lots of comparisons to Brexit. Here were the similarities that people really ticked off. One thing is this really upended conventional wisdom. This, you know, people were expecting a vote for the status quo in the U.S. and to stay in the EU last summer. Also, a sense that this was fueled to some degree by white voters who are uneasy about the changing racial makeup of their countries. You also had a lot of people in England and in the U.S. who've lost industrial jobs to globalization, whether you're talking about Detroit or Northeast England. And just also a sense that you had a populist anti-establishment message that really resonated.
You know, you mentioned the concern about changing demographics. The one really clear thing that people in Britain seem to be able to agree on is that they want to regain control over immigration, regain control over who comes and goes from Britain.
Absolutely. And that has continued to be a big issue. And it's not a clear exactly what Britain's going to do about it, because in order to get that, they're going to have to give up access to the European Union, which is going to basically have the economy here take a pretty big hit, I think.
Any idea what a President Trump means for the special relationship, as it is so often called, between Britain and the United States?
Well, Prime Minister Theresa May, as you would expect, said that it will continue. It could be helpful in terms of bilateral free trade. Trump, of course, was against Brexit and basically said that he would treat Great Britain really, really well in a bilateral free trade agreement later. But there's also concern about NATO, because Mr. Trump has said that he might not really want to protect, say, the Baltic states. And that, of course, makes the British pretty concerned.
And other NATO nations as well will be wondering what Donald Trump does about that. Frank, thanks very much.
Happy to do it, Steve.
That's NPR's Frank Langford in London. This is NPR News.
8:41 already, 19 now before 9. Morning Edition continues from WGTD HD. If you just joined us, tuning in for the WGTD Morning Show with Greg Berg. Preempted today so we can carry expanded post-election coverage from NPR. Greg will return tomorrow. And more election analysis and coverage on the way next.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the classic novel True Grit is the subject of a big read adventure this fall throughout the Gateway Technical College District. While supplies last, free copies are available at all Gateway libraries and at any public library within the Gateway District.
Now that forecast from the National Weather Service looks like this: sunny and seasonal today with a high heading for 57. We'll take that. Normal high this time of year is 50. The record high was 75, November 9th, 1999. Now 42 in Racine, 40 Kenosha, 37 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.
Carolina, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Wisconsin. From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. In about an hour, Hillary Clinton is expected to offer her first public comments on losing to Donald Trump. The Republican nominee will be the nation's 45th president after beating Clinton in Tuesday's election. Trump won key states, including Florida, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Wisconsin. Republicans also maintained control of Congress. Two death penalty measures were on the ballot in California. As Danielle Carson reports, voters said no to eliminating capital punishment, opting instead to back Proposition 66.
Voters decided the better option was to reform the death penalty system. More than 700 prisoners are on death row in California, but only 13 have been executed since 1978. Death row inmates wait at least 5 years just to be assigned a defense attorney to handle their appeals. Under Prop 66, the court will appoint counsel right after the trial to handle the automatic appeal.
In Brussels, Terry Schultz has reaction to Trump's victory from NATO.
U.S. Ambassador to NATO Doug Lutz has been serving in U.S. administration since the early 90s, and he's urging everyone not to worry about comments made on a campaign trail. Lutz says with the 28 democracies that make up NATO, elections and political shifts are a constant phenomenon. And for 67 years, Lutz says, the alliance has held together fine.
I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
And good morning for WGTD News. I'm Dave McGrath. Despite pre-election polls that suggested a different outcome, Wisconsin went for Donald Trump last night by 3 percentage points, 49-46. Here are the results from the other races on the ballot. Congressman Paul Ryan easily retained his first congressional district seat, beating Ryan Solon. Incumbent GOP Senator Ron Johnson also defied the polls and beat Russ Feingold by about 7 points. There were no surprises in local legislative races. GOP Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, Democrat Corey Mason, and Republicans Tyler August and Samantha Kirkman all won their races. All other local legislative races were uncontested. Statewide at this point, the Democrats are still in danger of losing maybe up to 3 state Senate seats. Final counts are still being tabulated. In a hard-fought and sometimes bitter race in Racine, Republican Assistant DA Patricia Hansen defeated Democrat Thomas Binger, a Kenosha County Assistant DA. She won by a 53-38 margin. The current DA, Rich Schipetti, decided not to run for re-election. And on a 3-1 margin, voters in the city of Burlington approved an advisory referendum to build a new $5.4 million community swimming pool. The final vote on the pool project rests with the Burlington City Council at its December 6th meeting. It is coming up now on 15 minutes before the hour.
LifeLock.com. From Audible, offering audiobooks on topics ranging from pop culture and the arts to literature and biographies. More at audible.com/listen. Audible, stories that surround you. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation at rwjf.org.
This is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Raised beadwork was once widely practiced by the Iroquois, but the art form had declined precipitously in the mid-20th century. But since the 1990s, Native artists have made a major effort to keep the tradition alive. I went to meet two Oneida artists at an exhibit of their work in Madison.
Becky Webster, Oneida, Wisconsin.
Loretta Webster, Oneida, Wisconsin. No relation.
I was beading since I was probably a teenager, but just experimenting on my own, but I didn't really get into beading until I took a few classes with Loretta, and that was about 12 years ago or so. It was kind of like a beading circle, and Loretta would make her way around and say, you know, that looks great, or, ooh, maybe you shouldn't do that.
There's excellent, excellent beaders, and you can probably learn just about anything you want. You know, ask any question you want, and there'll be someone in the beading circle that can help you. Oh, I've been beading since I was about 20 years old, and I'm 77 now. But I learned to bead raised beadwork in the 90s. And I started teaching almost right away. I had a store, and I started giving classes almost immediately because people wanted me to show them how to do things. I have tried basket making. And I have 3 baskets half done, and I've done pottery. I've taken several Oneida pottery classes and never really finished any of that. And I've got a whole box of yarn to make a yarn belt. Never even started it because I always finish my raised beading. So I figure this is my calling. Don't try to mess around with anything else. This is it.
Well, the favorite thing that I'd made is just what I made this summer, where I combined a little bit of the traditional raised beadwork with the contemporary. I'm a big Star Trek fan. So I have the glass cabochons in here with the Star Trek symbols, but they're incorporated into different parts of the traditional beadwork. So like this design here is part of our creation story. It's the celestial tree. And then on the back, I have incorporated into the floral patterns, and center stage is hopefully the most recognizable of the Star Trek symbols, and just into a raised beadwork floral pattern. And this is one of my favorite pieces so far. I made my husband a pair of matching cuffs, but his has the Marvel characters on the inside. So, and also he has My moccasins have the Star Trek symbol, and his moccasins are actually a Deadpool character from Marvel Comics. And what we do a lot of times is try to make our traditional shirts into clothing that you wear every day. So between the beadwork, like this collar that I have, I had it on before with a pair of jeans and a regular shirt. So it's bringing it into everyday life too, not just at powwow time or at ceremonies and stuff.
I retired 2012, and in those 3 years, I have never been without a commission. You know, people who really want something done in raised beadwork, though. It keeps me busy, but I love it. I bead every day, whether I have a commission or not.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm
now Eric. 10 minutes in front of 9 o'clock as Morning Edition continues from WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. Quick reminder, no morning show today. It was preempted, so we bring you expanded coverage of the election results from yesterday. And coming up shortly, more election analysis and coverage from National Public Radio and the fall forecast from the National Weather Service.
Gustav Mahler's remarkable First Symphony headlines the Lake Geneva Symphony's first concert of the season, Saturday, November 19th at Calvary Community Church in Williams Bay. For tickets, visit lakegenevaorchestra.org. The symphony is a proud supporter of WGTD.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with James Fallows, who has been writing an election blog for The Atlantic. He's the magazine's national correspondent. Earlier this year, he wrote an article called How America is Putting Itself Back Together, based on 3 years of flying around the country in a single-engine plane. Join us.
Fresh Air, tonight at 7 on WGTD.
Hi, I'm Bob Tenuta of the Gateway Radio Reading Service. We volunteers read the local newspapers to the visually impaired over the radio. Would you like to do the same and not having to move one toe out of your home? Call me at 564-3870.
Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service on this Wednesday the 9th. A sunny and seasonal day today with a high heading for 57. It is now 42 degrees in Racine, 40 Kenosha, 37 this morning for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.
Support also comes from Park Bank. Dedicated to making dream homes a reality, Park Bank is an equal housing lender that has served the residents of Madison with personalized mortgage services for 50 years. More at parkbank.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News with Renee Montaigne. I'm David Green.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. If you are among those shocked by Donald Trump's presidential victory last night, consider how people in Mexico must feel. NPR's Carrie Kahn is in Mexico City, in the country that has heard Trump's promise to build a wall and force Mexico to pay for it. Hi, Carrie.
Good morning, Steve.
What are people saying there?
Well, as it is around much of the world, it's shock, and that's the word that was used in a few of the newspaper headlines in large letters this morning. Worldwide uncertainty, Trump won, now what? And also there was the peso in free fall, and that was one of the biggest shocks of the night. The peso plunged in after-hour trading by more than 13% of its value over the day before, and that's the biggest drop in the peso since the so-called tequila crisis of 1994. The peso has recovered a bit this morning, but it is still trading at more than 20 pesos to the dollar. And that prompted Mexico's finance minister and the head of the central bank to come out this morning and speak to reporters, trying to assure markets that the Mexican economy is stable, has strong dollar reserves, they said, and a robust international lines of credit. And they did not announce any emergency monetary measures.
Just so I understand, it takes 20 pesos now to get a dollar. What was it a few days ago? Any idea?
18 and a half. It's been fluctuating the entire time, and it goes up and down. It had been going up and down with Donald Trump's poll numbers.
So like a lot of people who do any kind of business with the United States, the value of their assets took a haircut and the expense of their business and many other things. What about people on the streets? What are they saying?
Well, the morning TV shows have been full of commentators expressing uncertainty over whether Trump will make good on these campaign promises. that we heard so much about, building the border wall, making Mexico pay for it, tearing up the free trade agreement. And I did spend much of last night and early into the morning at this Texas barbecue restaurant here in Mexico City and spoke to many Mexicans that were just depressed and in shock. One international headhunter told me that it'll be nearly impossible in her job to attract talent to Mexico because of the peso being so low. I also talked to Carlos Martinez. He's an international lawyer. And he says he's just depressed about the results and very nervous about what Trump will do to Mexico's economy.
If our biggest partner is going to like put limitations on the trade that we have with the U.S., that's going to definitely impact our economy. So I'm actually very worried about that.
And in the short term, his worries have been realized with that dramatic fall of the peso.
Carrie, we're about to go across the border and hear how things sound from Texas. Can you give me an idea of how vital trade is across that border, how important it is first to Mexico?
Well, the United States is Mexico's number one trading partner. $1.5 billion, nearly $1.5 billion of trade every day is done between the two countries. Mexico is the U.S.'s third largest trading partner after Canada and China. So it's just a complex, intricate, intertwined economy that it'll be difficult to dismantle that relationship in any way without harming either of the economies.
Including Americans, as we'll hear in a moment. Let me just ask very briefly, Mexico's president, who hosted Donald Trump during the campaign, what's he saying about all this?
He tweeted this morning his congratulations to President-elect Donald Trump and once again stressed the friendship of the two countries that he said should continue to work together for the competitiveness and the development of North America.
President Enrique Peña Nieto, who will now be dealing with President-elect, soon-to-be President Trump. Carrie Kahn, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
All right, Steve, let's indeed go across that border and into the state of Texas, which handed Donald Trump 38 electoral votes last night. Any hope the Democrats had of younger Latino voters turning the Lone Star State blue were wiped out by Trump's very strong support among white men, which was a trend across the country. NPR's John Burnett covers Texas and the U.S. border. He joins us from San Antonio. Good morning, John. Where are you hanging out?
Hey, David. I'm actually at a kind of a famous local restaurant, El Milagrito, which is the Little Miracle Cafe.
Ah.
For those, and this is central San Antonio, for those who are hoping for a miracle for Hillary, it definitely didn't happen last night. I've been speaking with lots of patrons here this morning over their chilaquiles and barbacoa tacos. And
you're making me hungry.
this is a great place. Gobsmacked incredulous has come up. You hear, I'm overhearing the, Trump at all the tables. That's what everybody is talking about. But really, there's just a lot of shock here this morning. Interestingly, though, especially from what Carrie, was speaking to Mexicans, we just heard, is Refugio Rodriguez. He's 48 years old. He's a music administrator from Houston. And interestingly, he told me that he had a feeling all along that Trump was going to surge, and he wasn't really hearing that in the media interviews before the election.
I think that sometimes in the media that you hear a lot from stories that want to make us feel good or want us to think a certain way, but when it comes down to it, it's the voter that makes the difference. And from what I would see, the people who actually said, "Are you voting?" What I saw was they were voting Trump.
Right. So this was just an enormous sort of reality check, he thought, that happened last night.
Well, it's interesting to hear Mr. Rodriguez say that, because there was a narrative building that Hillary Clinton could win a lot of Latino voters, even compete in a state like Texas. It sounds like in many parts of the country, at least some parts of the country, Donald Trump actually picked up more Latino support than Mitt Romney had 4 years ago. What do you make of that? There was a perception that a lot of Latinos might not love the hardline anti-immigration message from Donald Trump.
Well, and that's very true, and a lot of them were really offended with how he referred to Latinos. But it's so complicated. And down here, the question of Hillary's stance on abortion rights, was not popular among Catholics. I don't think she just energized people. She wasn't a popular candidate. I talked to folks in South Texas yesterday, and they just, weren't excited by her. And in fact, several folks here in the cafe this morning, Mexican Americans I spoke to, they didn't vote at all, and they just kind of shrugged their shoulders. But I do want to one more piece of tape here. This is from Richard Ramirez. He's 46 years old, a registered nurse. And again, it's like, he's not feeling like the sky is going to fall.
I think that process will work. I don't think he's just going to be able just to
say I'm going to start deporting people left and right, there's going to be a process. There's going to be people in the government and the Congress and the Senate who are going to have their say, as it should.
So he's hoping the three branches of government prove their worth.
All right. Speaking to NPR's John Burnett in San Antonio, Texas. As you're listening to our campaign coverage, the election coverage on Morning Edition from NPR News with Steve Inskeep and Renee Montaigne, I am David Green.
8:59, 1 minute now before 9 o'clock. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, NPR News, and classical music on your gateway to public radio. Greg Berg will be back with a brand new morning show tomorrow. Once again, if you joined late, the morning show was preempted today, so we could bring you expanded post-election coverage from NPR's Morning Edition. We'll have more news coming up at 9:01. Then we'll join Wisconsin Public Radio for their classical music programming right after that.
...24/7 jazz on WGTD HD2. Jazz, swing, blues, bop, and more, airing right now on HD2. For more information, go to www.